Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
Significant verticals out there that would get really testy if you start messing with things in flight. I just herald back to the first days of the man in the middle SSL cert on your perimeter discussions, the ethical discussions of that in some places, especially if you're doing things like research and others that where the data sets matter. I like the concept, but I don't know. Messing with things in flight, the integrity piece becomes a real that's the debate right there. Well, everybody, welcome. We're here for our annual, and I hope it becomes a recurring annual for our
Me
second
too.
Annual of many discussion with Forrester analyst Jess Byrne, who brings along with her top recommendations for our security programs. Jess, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back. I'm glad to be here, and that, you know, you didn't think the first time was so bad that you didn't want me to come back. So
no, the first time was wonderful. And I like I said, I want to make this mark your calendars, listeners. This April, May of next year, we'll be back. Same bat time, same bat channel, same bat report, but with the 2023 on it. And we'll do this again. But before we get to next year, let's start with this year. Jess, what have you been up to? What are you working on? And tell me a little bit about this report and how it came to be and what you learned out of it.
Sure. So yeah, I've completed my first year as an analyst. It was a whirlwind. I've actually finished my first wave. So Forrester clients, check out the one on incident response services. A lot of changes in where those dots are on the wave graphic. So definitely check that out. A lot more to incident response than just incident response as well. So that's a plug for my wave. And then one of the other reports that I worked on was the one that we're talking about today, which is the top recommendations for your security program for 2022. Now, this is always a group effort. And it's an annual report as well. We also have top threats, and then we do predictions. So those are some of the reports that we do every year. And it starts with a big, you know, multi-week brainstorming exercise for the 20 plus folks on the security and risk research team covering a number of different topics. So everybody gets together and says, what have we heard from our clients, you know, over the last year? What makes sense for us to recommend for 2022? Across, you know, again, identity, risk, everything you can think of, security operations. And so this year, if you think back to 2021 and those recommendations, that was everybody picking themselves up and dusting themselves off from 2020. So the theme of that, as we discussed, was, you know, what do you do in the short term? And then what do you do in the long term? Just to sort of normalize life when it comes to your security program. This year, everybody's picking themselves up and dusting themselves off from 2021.
Didn't really go the way we thought it would. Did
no,
it?
No, it did not. You know, it was just another year of the same. So, but in that year, security leaders fought the good fight and really the spotlight that had started to shine on them really, really came home in 2021. And the security leaders got a lot of juice. So what we wanted to say is, hey, you know, you've wanted this, you've wanted the access, you've wanted the influence, you wanted to make an impact on the board and the C-suite. Now's the time, right? You've got the goodwill. If you made it through 2021 with, you know, minor incidents, or you were able to clean up something big, you know, and keep moving your security program forward, you're a hero, right? You're a hometown hero in your organization. So use that capital to do some things, to tackle some things that have been hanging around for a long time. So there's a few of those in the top program recommendations, which we'll get into. And then also to think about, you know, what's next and what's new and how you deal with, I hate to say the new normal, but, you know, whatever this world looks like moving forward when it comes to the workforce and hybrid work. So that's sort of where we took it, is it's time to do more with more. So get out there and use that political capital for good and for your program. So that's the main theme of the report for this year.
Very cool. Before we dive into some of the specifics and start talking about them, was there one element that sung to you out of the things that came out of this?
I mean, I love all these.
I love all my children.
But selfishly, one of the ones that I was really glad made the cut was recommendation number 5, which is treat security staffing for what it is. It's different, right? So I don't even want to use the term great resignation. I think everybody's tired of it. But my colleague, Janet Worthington, actually coined a new term, and maybe it wasn't her originally, but when she said it, we all loved it. And it's really the great reshuffle when it comes to security staff, right? They didn't leave the workforce. They just went somewhere else. And they went somewhere else for a number of different reasons. There wasn't a clear path for advancement. The money wasn't good, or the flexibility wasn't good. So people were finding themselves scrambling, right, to keep the talent that they had. And for security, you know, regardless maybe of what your HR policies are, we are recommending that if they want the flexibility, give them the flexibility. If they need a clear path for advancement, start a succession planning program. You know, if you're looking for folks to at the entry level to replace folks that have been promoted internally, blow up your hiring practices, get rid of, you know, the software you're using that filters people out because they don't have specific certifications or they don't have a bachelor's degree, for the love of God. You know, you've got to think about security staffing differently if you're going to build your team and make sure that you have a team that is happy and thriving and moving forward in this world. And that means, you know, if they want to move, think about letting them move if it's a top performer. So that's the crux of that particular recommendation. And I'm going to be writing some more about that. I did a talk last year on succession planning for security. That's turning into a report soon. I feel really strongly that you need to give people even more than compensation. They just want to know where they go next. What's their path? And you want to keep them. So make sure that you think about how they move into different roles, all the way from, you know, a SOC analyst into an incident responder, and maybe eventually managing security operations. Think about their path. And then I'm about to write a report on the state of security certifications too. And we've done some really interesting sentiment analysis. I'm not going to even give too many spoilers for that, because I think it's going to be really interesting for folks to look at where that stands in terms of certifications. So more to come on that.
Well, I think all three of our sentiment is on record in some past episode at some point on certifications versus experience. Yeah. I look forward to that. I think I want to just start to seed the discussion on the staffing part and just say, you know, security hasn't been a rock star area up to now. We've had rock stars in the field, but we haven't been that area that's been the outlier. In my organization, I have more than just security teams. I have now, you know, I have a bunch of other things that are near but aren't in this same scope or in this same level of demand. Now you're starting to talk about differentiating pay. You're creating a rock star group that gets paid or compensated or incentivized differently than groups that sit very close to the security teams. And, you know, HR have long been about, you know, creating equality, now we're creating equity across the organization. And these kind of things don't always sit well with the people who aren't part of them. You know, by doing this, do we start to create some kind of a disparity that then has a ripple on effect? Which, you know, at the end of the day, if everybody gets paid more, that's good too. Mm-hmm. But you know, that's the first thing that comes to mind when I think about carving out a large chunk of outliers.
The government just did it.
I know.
So, I actually didn't know that until reading this. I didn't realize that.
The GS, the GS is blown up.
That's crazy. Yeah. I didn't think that would ever happen.
So they're treating it differently, right? And then one of our other program recommendations is to look into government as a source of good for once, right? This plays into that. They're treating security staffing for what it is. It's different. they're paying the big bucks. They're not going to necessarily be paying the big bucks for somebody in enterprise architecture, but they will in security. So to me, that was a big signal as well, because the private sector is now going to lose people to, of all places, the federal government.
And that's never been a destination that people really were concerned about. And I'm, I mean, I'm glad the government is a great resource.
I'm glad to see top talent maybe going there. Sure, we could use them as a nation. But they did it. So to me, that's, you know, that's a big sign that this is different. And I don't know, what do you guys think about hiring and about that disparity?
I'll tell you what, when I read this section, the one word came to mind, and that was amen. This was spot on. That we continue to look at staffing from a historical point of view and doing it the same thing that we've always done. And that's not going to get us into the future. I love the aspect about the flexibility. And I mean, the thing we think about and how we look at capacity and all of that has to change, because our worlds have changed, that we can't focus on this 9 to 5, you know, Monday through Friday. And we've got to do things differently.
The attackers stop at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, they're good. They clock out.
American time. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Think about what you just said, though. So, attackers clock out at 6 o'clock, but are the attackers, do the attackers actually have to show up to your office to attack? No, they can be anywhere in the world.
That's right.
So then why does your security staff have to?
Yeah, but
right
I put
here?
A banner on our VPN login telling them that they can't connect. Oh. So they shouldn't be able to, right?
I didn't even think about that. Good job. Way to put the bear. I got a question.
Clearly the theme is that what we have to change our whole mindset, which is, I guess, has been happening in the field for a long time. And I guess it almost feels like for those of us that have been in it for a long time, we've been sort of slow boiling with it. I was having a discussion earlier this week, just looking back and saying, you know, we have come such a long way in the 27 years now that I've been in this field. And you don't always realize it as you come along. But I think this moment, for those of us that haven't been all the way along, I think this may be a very noticeable change work style, in pay style, in culture, in just some of the habits that have to be there in order for us to actually be effective at what we do.
So I want to throw this out there, and this is first towards Eric, but then I want to hear Dan and Jess's opinion. There was a gentleman about 6 months ago who had reached out to me and said, "Hey, Brian, we don't know each other. You know, I'm a relative of so-and-so. I was told to contact you, you know, and get your thoughts on how to get in or break into the security world. I'm currently going after my CompTIA. I'm taking this class. I'm trying to get these accreditations. And what do you think I should do next? And should I start applying now?" And I said, "Absolutely start applying." And I go, "And here's my recommendation on how to do that. Send me your resume. I'm going to clean a few things up. Here's what I would stress on your resume, even though you have zero experience. Go back and show your dedication as a leader when you were in sports and this, and your dedication, how you played through high school and college. You know, go show all this information." Lands a job. And he said, "I got an offer for a help desk," right, "for a very large company." I said, "That's a great place to start."
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Less than five months in, he pings me. He goes, "Brian, I think I'm burnt out." He goes, "I literally spend all my time just updating people's emails because they can't remember their passwords." He goes, "Literally, that's all I do." He goes, "I really thought I'd be doing more. This really wasn't what I signed up for." And the thing is, it was a good opportunity for him because he could work remote. But he's remote, so he's out of sight, out of mind. And all they have him handling is the same thing. It reminds me of the days when you heard about the Model T at Ford Motor Company, and you sped the line up until someone screamed, and they did the same mundane job over and over and over and over again. That's not going to work. So I felt bad for him, but I said, "I don't know what to say besides I would stick it out for one year, because then from there, you know," and, you know, he wrote back, but I want to toss that out to you because here's an opportunity where someone got in, but again, in 5 months, they're just doing a really mundane task, but it's because the business itself, the people don't really care to ever remember their passwords. It's like, "Well, I'll just hit IT up and they can update it for me." But when you're working for a company that has 240,000 employees, right? I mean, you're doing it all the time.
Yeah. I think that comes back to what Jess and Dan were talking about on creating purpose. Right? That we have to be cognizant on, understanding where somebody wants to be, what they want to do, and being able to show them that career path. I mean, look, if somebody's looking to chase money, they're going to chase money all day, and you can hop around companies, they'll achieve that. But I think people will stay if there is a purpose for them, if there is a career path to grow them. And part of that starts with just having a conversation. I'm starting to realize more and more that as you look at a lot of security practitioners, that you've got on one side, you've got those of us that like the multiple hats, that I don't want to do the same thing day in, day out. I want to do some technical. I like some of the awareness piece. I like having conversations, and that's cool. But then you have to recognize there's also this whole contingent of people that, well, I just like the techie spot piece of it, right? I just want to be in the EDR platform all day. I just want to be responding, and that's all I want to do.
I don't want to be a manager.
Right.
And if right? I was just about to say, that comes down to leadership style, not teaching people how to manage, but teaching how to be leaders. And in the security space, as people come up, like Eric, you've read a lot of books, right, about leadership style, then given the opportunity to do it, you do realize that applying it, a lot of it is learning how to listen to people, right? It's learning people's emotions, how people feel, how people interact.
Right.
Now, if we're not in the office space, what are these people's emotions at home? So listening to people, right? Like having a conversation where you set it up maybe quarterly to ask them how they're doing, what things do they want to do? You know, like, anyways, I'm probably beating that one.
No, I mean, it's a good conversation, because I think we all run into this all the time. I mean, have the conversation with HR organizations when you're talking about promoting people. And one of the questions that always comes up, well, what's their propensity to lead people? Why does that matter?
Who cares?
Why is that the only angle
of awesome technology?
Right.
Yeah.
And don't give them staff and pay them like they're gold.
Yeah. Luckily, we finally got to a part. And actually, the piece of the equation that drove that was engineering. Recognizing you could have a tremendous engineer that wants to continue to grow and pour back into the organization, but is not suited, does not want to lead people. And they finally created a path. And then from an IT perspective, we were able to use that as well. And we now have architecture roles that are in there and have been able to promote people in there that are senior manager levels, but they're solo contributor. And that's where they want to be.
I want to flip this though a little. One of the pieces is about in this section is about flexibility. And there is the desire for flexibility. And I'm purposely going to the other side of the discussion here. But, you know, Brian, your example called out the person who was remote, unknown, new to the organization, got the crap jobs, you know, the crappier part of the tasks. This is something people should consider, though, when thinking about the fully remote lifestyle, especially in an organization that isn't culturally prepped to be remote. And I think this, just being remote is only half the equation. So as managers, as leaders, as culture definers in an organization, people need to be defining to be able to truly support these remote workers, this remote lifestyle. But realizing that at 5 months, if it isn't there, it probably isn't going to be. Jess, you're nodding your head.
That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I think fully remote work is easier for people who might be a little further along, right, in their mm-hmm. in their careers, right? So, you know, Forrester has moved to anywhere work. I've seen the folks that are actually in the office, our headquarters in Cambridge, our New York office, are sometimes my colleagues who are, you know, at my level of seniority, but more often than not, it's our more junior folks, our research associates, it's our sales folks, right? They might still live with their parents, or they might live with four of their roommates, right? So they want to get out of the house, whereas someone like me is perfectly happy to stay in all the time. You know, I'm good. I've been doing remote work for 10 years almost now, so I've got it down. But I also worked in an office for my first 11, right, with Forrester for a long time. So I still know people. We're going up there in May, and I'm so excited. But so I think you do have to think about offering flexibility and also allowing someone to come into an office if they need it. And I think for people looking for their first couple of jobs, you might want to think about having an office culture that's still available. And I think Forrester's actually doing a really good job at that. I don't know if there's other examples that you want to bring up, but you know, they're offering community to the folks that need it. And I think that's really important.
It's the right way to do it.
I'll tell you from my own experience, you know, starting in a new organization, I mean, for 2.5 years, have not been able to meet the people I work with.
Yeah.
And you know, every one of those is very, is you know, it requires a lot more work and consciousness to build the relationships, to do those things, things that happen very easily over the coffee pot or in, you know, in a hallway. And so just realizing that things may move a little slower, and that as a manager, as a lead, as somebody who has people who are in remote or maybe not, and I've been working in remote work life. I've had remote teams for 23 years. So it's not new to me, but it still is. It's tiring. It's conscious. It's a real thing. And yeah, having that, you know, hybrid work, will I go back to an office full time? Probably not, but having the opportunity, and, you know, next week I'm making a first trip, to an office, in a very long time. And I'm really looking forward to it for all of those reasons. Cause I expect that in 1 week, I'll be able to accomplish probably what would take 8 to 10 weeks of relationship building and of catch up time, in a very efficient way. And that's at a senior level. But yeah, as somebody who's just coming into the workforce or just coming into a role or into the field, that is a very different thing to be isolated in your own place as you try and learn an organization and the dynamics. You can't overhear how people interact with each other, those kinds of things.
So one thing I was going to throw out there, because Jess, in the report was one of the eight, there was adjust security awareness programs for anywhere work. And I look at this as, for years we've had on-prem, which you could say was working from an office, or even your previous architecture was all on-prem. Now people are going through their digital transformation, moving things to the cloud or doing a hybrid of it. But the same could be said of how we work, anywhere work. Like in the, you mentioned, for very old organizations, you know, who have scaled to be, you know, 200,000 employees or 100,000 employees or even 50,000 employees, that would be really, really hard. And that's just like companies that have grown from having all of this on-prem to trying to use the cloud, move to the cloud and do things. But you realize at some point, the reasons why the benefits are there when you start to do the move. And the first things that do move, you're like, okay, we learned this, we learned that. And then this goes right into the other piece when you talked about the cloud security posture management, being able to see some of your tech debt, you know, from a vulnerability side, you begin to learn that as you do it. And I think the same could be said from anywhere work. As you begin to do that transformation, and it happened in the blink of an eye because of COVID, and people were trying to adjust to it, and you realized maybe some of the debt you had from coming to the office, but you also, Dan, from what you just said, realized some of the losses. Right. And Jess, you mentioned when someone first starts a job, right? Like maybe they're living at home. They've been living at home or living in a dorm for a really long period of time. They were just hoping to go out into the world and spread their wings. Giving them the ability to do that might be the reason they stay on for 2 to 3 years longer, right? Rather than just saying after 5 months, I'm flying. Right. Mm-hmm. So I really like number eight in there, because I think all of this kind of pieces together, if people look at it, you know, not just at the point value, but the whole value of all of these points.
Yeah. So this is an interesting one. We when we were doing the brainstorming about this, all of us had mentioned, like, I've worked with people now for a solid year that I've not met in person. I'm going to be meeting these people in May at our headquarters in Cambridge, and I'm very excited. Just like
you're much taller than you look in Zoom.
Oh, listen, that's come up on our. That's come up many times. I have people who are convinced that I'm now 6'7", because a colleague keeps saying that. There's all kinds of things, but so I'm 5'2". It's all over the map. One of the reasons we put this recommendation out there was because everyone got so focused on remote work. And now I actually think it's going to be very difficult to do anywhere work where you are constantly going home, office, trip, back to home, back to the office. It's really makes security awareness a little bit difficult. One, you don't know how tall people are, right? You may not know what someone looks like from behind. So if you need to think about things again, like turnstiles, right? You need to think about your office building and physical security when it comes to security awareness training. And I'd love to hear what you guys have to say, but I actually was on a call with a group of CISOs from Forrester just a few days ago, where they we're just still talking about how much work it was to adjust policies for work from home. Like they're still getting out the messages about don't have your Alexa on or your Echo Dot or something else in your office. And, you know, make sure you're not sharing your laptop with other people and make sure you're in a good location. And they all admitted, gosh, we haven't thought about what it looks like to have a portable, so to speak, security awareness and training program. So I think that's the next phase. So we're recommending that people think about what, how do you adjust your security awareness training for this world where people are bringing their identities and their devices to a number of different locations, and they're not set at home and they're not set in an office.
But how is that different from the way we treated road warriors for decades? People who would work from from the first days that Starbucks got Wi-Fi, they were there. They were in the office a bit. They were on planes and others. Can we use the same mindset?
I think you can. Yeah, I think you can. I think people just haven't thought about it. And it was kind of clear to me last week that people were still in the got to secure the remote, you know, got to secure the home office. So
it's a binary ends of the of
just
the,
like it was pencil. Binary before for the most part, you know, and that's why all of our monitoring software broke when it came to user behavior and all of that, because everything changed, you know.
And Jess, I'm not going to pivot here real quick. And Eric, I'm going to throw this over to you a little bit. What you just said, the ability to adjust fast, this brings me right into the article about Starlink and what Elon Musk did, right? Where blocking the electromagnetic wave attacks from Russia overnight changes one line of code. And now the government a month later is looking at that and saying, wow, their ability to move fast, to change something in less than 24 hours, they looked internally and said, let's look in the mirror. That would have taken us months because we had to put together an analysis report, figure out what we needed to do, then outsource it to who is ever going to make the change, right? And it's like, they're like, we really need to look at the ability to move fast. And that goes right into where you were talking about the minimal MVS, the minimal viable security. And you talked about the tent, right? And Eric, we've talked about this before. The idea of people are used to getting things really fast, right? New updates, new change, but what's beta and what's not? But a tent is good enough for some things, but you have to realize the tent doesn't have the foundation, the running water. But when you look at anywhere work, a tent can go really almost anywhere in the world if it's the right tent, but there's certain things you won't have. But if you had a building and a foundation, you just can't move that everywhere you want to go. So the tent helps organizations that are looking for certain security postures that can be remote. And that's where it comes down, Dan, you were talking about new products. So I went very wide and far there, but it all comes back to the adjusting fast.
That can be summarized by Brian saying, star.
I think it highlights the need for agility to be an underpinning tenet of all of our controls, right? That what we're doing today is not likely what we're going to be doing tomorrow. So we have to put ourselves in a position that we can adapt very quickly. I mean, as it pertains to security awareness, I really think we need to start getting away from these traditional, you shall watch this video once a year. Yes. You're going to read this email. We got to start getting into kind of real-time reminders to curb behavior while it's happening. I've seen some smaller practitioners, companies that seem to be coming up in this space to allow some of the real-time activity. But I think there needs to be, that's poised for a lot more investment. Just little reminder. I mean, think about it. Like anybody who's using, Office 365 and Microsoft, you can turn on different alerts that, hey, you're sending out this file. Do you really want to send out this file? Just to make people aware. That's where we need to be, and constantly little hints to curb behavior along the way.
I mean, think if every board member had to read Dawn of the Code War or Future Crimes, they'd be like, huh? Wait, is this real?
Right.
Yeah. So, and actually, I'm curious about that. So I was having a discussion about security insurance and some of the moves toward
and how that's
phishing,
a checkbox
testing.
Activity now?
What's that?
I said, and how that's a checkbox activity now?
Well, exactly. And there was a list of like 13 things that insurers require in order, and it's a growing list of things, but it's completely prescriptive. And I think a bit out of touch, but in this one, it comes back to awareness is you know, the idea of to what extent are you awaring versus testing? And it seems like testing is falling into those regimes where I still maintain, and I'll probably go to my grave defending the idea that I don't want to try and trick people in the office.
Right.
And I think remote reinforced that, where I can't be in my office with a group of people outside receiving it and hearing the response and knowing how, like, you don't know, you're sort of yelling into the void when you do these kinds of things, and you don't know how they're landing. And in order to create a culture that's open to be up for all the other things we want to do, I never want to test and try and trick employees. Like, hello, this mail we sent you, you clicked on it, it was actually phishing and I sent it. Ha ha, you fool. That's not my, you know, that's not a way to build a good
right.
foundation. But I'm also seeing these requirements that you must run phishing tests. So we're getting to an interesting place where people are trying to shape how awareness happens.
Yeah. So I'll take the other side of that, not the extreme other side though, but I feel there's still got to be some accountability, because I do agree with the mentality that we should see ourselves as a partner with different facets of the business and helping them understand how to make the correct risk decisions. But at the end of the day, if there's no accountability structure, what's the incentive to actually do those behaviors? Anything that requires a little bit of extra friction, well, why would I do that? There's nothing you can do about it.
Tie it to business outcomes and business impact, meaning the reason you should be conscious is because the entire bit, and maybe this works better in the small medium world where people feel more closely tied to the business at hand.
Right.
I guarantee it, again, my 100,000 person companies wouldn't necessarily have landed that way. But I promise you, in the $1 to $10 billion companies, they understand how business happens. So, and what that doing something wrong and how this could trade on to having material impact on top and bottom lines. That is, I think maybe the answer is it's different when you get too big to be close to the business and you're just in the back, you feel like you're in the back room just cranking, but not knowing to what.
Yeah. Well, and depending on the size of the company, the vertical, the culture, there's so many different, it's the famous Dan Aiello phrase, it depends.
It depends.
Right. There's different levers that you can pull to try to curb behavior and incentivize the right behavior. And that's going to be dependent on the organization. But yeah, Brian kind of dropped a comment in the text. I would never advocate going to the lengths of shaming people, because that's creating the wrong, you might get the proper response today, but you're certainly not getting it tomorrow. You're doing it for the wrong reasons.
I'll be the first to say I've been fooled. I have done it. I will do it again. There is no shame in doing it. What you need to do is just come back and say, I did it. I never want someone to feel like they have to hide it.
Right. Right. That's where you're going to actually have more issues, right? So my colleague, Janann Budge, and Dan, you know her well, writes all about this, right? And she did a talk at our forum last fall about that, like by using positive reinforcement. So there are a couple companies that I spoke to recently that had some social engineering going on. It was a combination of, you know, email and phone calls, believe it or not, they're from an agency purporting to work with a CEO of a company, right? And so and they called a remote office. They called someone that works, they were remote, but they worked in an office out of this country, right? And that person actually went and contacted the CEO's admin and said, I'm getting these messages. I've got this email, forwarded the email. Is this legit? And it wasn't. And so the company wrote up a whole case study and said, look at this. Look at this wonderful level of vigilance, and rewarded that person. Mm-hmm. And that person also felt comfortable reaching out to the CEO via the admin. You have to create a culture where you can ask questions, or you're going to have people that are going to fall for social engineering and business email compromise and other scams and other security issues, physical security and everything else. If you're not going to ask someone who they are because you don't recognize them, you know, or tell them, go to the desk, I'm not going to let you use the turnstile right after me and just drift in. I think that's important. It's teaching people that it's okay to question things is, I think, a big part of positive security awareness.
Absolutely.
And even more so in a remote and hybrid world where you're not able to walk up there and say, Bill or Jane, did you really send this? You feel a little more disconnected in a remote world. It's easier to feel disconnected.
Yeah. And Eric, I thought this was great. Jess, way to tie that back in, because it really does come down to trust. Eric, the number one reason people were afraid to pull the Ondong cord at NUMMI was they didn't trust that the management wouldn't fire them for right. stopping the assembly line, right. right? And it takes the management there. So if you send out a 10-question, questionnaire and someone gets five of them wrong and at the end it says, you scored 50%, now they're like, oh my gosh, is that bad? But if they understood at the very end, like, thank you, 50% is not bad. We need to improve as a security team and how we educate, if they feel that that was the read behind it, right, then they feel great about it. Imagine putting out a questionnaire about the culture in a company and that people were afraid to put a negative answer so that if it was negative, they just left it blank. And you get this thing back and you're like, well, all the ones they answered were great. We're doing amazing. No, your internal culture is toxic because people were afraid that this really wasn't, when someone says the questionnaire is completely confidential, that they didn't trust that it was confidential. So they were so worried about it that right. they weren't willing to fill it out. Yeah. Right. So I think just going back to the number one, or I shouldn't say the number one,
but it was number one on the list.
One listed as number one.
Yeah. The one listed as number one for those that are going to either A, read it or look it up on the Forrester guide was add trust to your role. And I don't think it's just CISOs that need to add trust to their role or security practitioners, that the board itself, that the business itself needs to trust the security leader. He needs to add that to his role so people realize that it's not shaming, when you're doing those type of right. phishing email scenarios, et cetera. And the more you do that, the more the business together with security will grow.
Yeah, this is one that we're actually doing more research on. My colleague Jeff Pollard is going to come out with more research on this, but it's been an interesting evolution. And we think this is the next move right, for CISOs. I was having a discussion with the group last week, and they were very interested in this as well. Many of them have already been doing it, right? Meeting with customers, meeting with employees, understanding, where the friction points are in employees doing their jobs and then in customers engaging with the organization. So going to market as a trusted business is a big differentiator with competition. I had a great panel discussion at our forum last fall with folks that were doing that. One was the CISO of Zoom, who talked about what it took to rebuild trust with customers and what they're continuing to do on an ongoing basis to make sure that everyone feels comfortable using this platform. Another was the CISO of Ginger, which is now part of Headspace Health. Everything about what they do, when you're talking about this is employer-funded online therapy, right, for employees, has to involve trust. And they actually had to answer questions about Zoom, which was their platform where people would talk to their therapists online. So Zoom and Ginger actually worked together to make both the practitioners and the folks that were using it on the employee level feel like they can trust this platform with very sensitive information. So, the CISO's role is really enabling a business to go to market on trust. Yeah. And we think that that's going to continue. It's actually almost feels like the right role for this. I feel like a lot of ethics end up with the CISO. I feel like there's a lot of things that the CISOs carry around now that's related to trust. It's product security. It's so many things. So we think that the title, Chief Trust Officer, is a possibility. And I know a few folks, and Dan, you probably remember a couple of them. One of the CISOs that used to be on the Security and Risk Council is now a Chief Trust Officer for a security tech firm. And she told me, if I ever went back to being a CISO after being a corporate board member for several years, I want to report to the CEO and I want trust in my title. And she got it, and I think that's going to be a trend. I think we're going to see more of this moving forward.
Yep. Well, that's the way I just defined my new role too.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly, for those exact reasons. And I mean, I think it's also helped out by the fact that now, at least in the US, the FTC, the SEC are putting more of this into the fiduciary responsibility of the board, which means that it is on the radar at the highest level.
That's right.
And not just the security, but also the outward facing components of it. So it's no longer, you know, security team go back there and crank in the back room, as I mentioned before. Now it's, this is a business differentiator. Well, those that are doing it right, this is a business differentiator. That's right. Though this is something that we can, you know, use to build our brand. It is a real piece of what we do. Although I'm curious how this translates into verticals that don't necessarily have that kind of direct, you know, they're not B2C, or it's a little more opaque, and it's harder to be able to translate trust into the thing you're selling, because it's not as easy to translate out into, this is a tent pole, this is a feature, this is Apple's privacy stance, you know, those kinds of things.
Well, so I have a good example for you, and then I'm sure you guys have some others, but Caterpillar, right? When the CISO was part of the Security and Risk Council, he has since, I think, retired, and there's a new CISO there, but he told a great story about winning business over a competitor for automated equipment, right? Stuff that would go and wreck small cities in a small South American town, right? If that thing were to be hacked, and that mining equipment was going to then go wild, right? They won business over a competitor by showing in detail what the security of those, you know, of those driverless automated vehicles were against the competition. Competition couldn't show that, right? So that's product security. That's differentiating with trust right there, and that brought them business. And I think it continues to do so.
And I really think this is going to grow in the automotive manufacturing realm as well. Because as you look at the different customers, everybody is concerned right now about supply chain disruption, and cyber is a huge component of that. And if you can differentiate yourself as a company, that you have a higher chance. I want to figure out how to phrase this to not, you know, kind of be the beating on the chest that we won't get hacked or anything along those lines. But if you can show that you've got a mature program, you may gain the upper hand in being able to win business, because you have a higher chance of being able to supply the components needed up to the OEMs to complete vehicles.
That's going to be a big deal. Yeah. You have to show to your main companies that with whom you're a supplier, your superior security. One of our predictions from for 2022 and beyond was that people are going to start looking into applying cyber insurance policies to weak links in their supply chain. Right. And saying, if you can't show me minimum viable security, if you can't show me that you actually have a mature program, then we're going to make sure that you take out a policy for our contract and name us as a beneficiary. Haven't seen it yet. Again, it was a prediction, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's, you know, starting to be in the works for some key supplier relationships.
I have heard discussions similar to that. You know, I'm insuring your legs for $20 million.
Yeah. Just like Lloyd's of London. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. But it's definitely, I'm hearing more and more discussion about it, and it takes one of two forms. Either we're going to invest in you to help you build out your security program to that key downstream supplier, because then we can have confidence. And that one is taking a little bit more precedence, because that ensures continuity. It's all fine and good if I get a check to cover the dollars, but I still have a disruption problem, and I still have a brand reputation. The customer that isn't getting their car doesn't care that I got a check for to be made whole for this gap in the thing, right? in the process. But I think it also highlights another, you know, as we're thinking about more holistic security, and I think this is the year that security is, or the last 2 years, that security is understood to be more than just confidentiality. We just talked about, it was all about availability. And availability, the CIA component of what makes up information security, the availability and integrity haven't been as loud. They haven't been as, they're not the innate thing that people think about when they think about security. The supply chain path highlights in the availability components, not just in system availability, but business process availability as well. And I think I'm hearing way more people talking about it.
And
availability equals trust, integrity equals trust. And confidentiality, I think, is now built into people. You know, we've baked that into the price of the stock now.
Right. But to echo what you were kind of saying, and this goes back to our last episode, I mean, even the SEC has now noticed this, that, hey, as shareholders, they need greater transparency and greater trust into the controls that are in place. So now we're going to start forcing companies to start disclosing. What does your ISMS look like? What are the procedures, the policies that you have underpinning your company, making sure that you are a worthwhile, trustworthy investment? I think it's a move in the right direction. And I'm right there with you, Jess. I think that CISOs are really poised to take on that trust aspect because it's really been setting central to everything that we do anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Two things I want to throw out there, and I'm going to back up just a hair because this is going to go back to, I think it's point number six, which was pay down your vulnerability debt now, but goes right into the conversation of B2C, Dan, and you asked for an example to Jess. This group of us getting together, Jess, all started from a conversation at an event where we were sitting down, and one of the things thrown across the table was on the whole idea of data, right? All the data that these businesses bring in, and how companies handle it. And one of the things that was thrown out there was automotive companies, and Dan, I'm going back to auto, but these big OEs will be looked at and judged in the future of how they handle all the data they plan to consume today, right? That everyone has seen what happened with some of the social media platforms, Google, et cetera, right? That they began collecting all this data. And even if their motto was don't be evil, 10 years later, people were like, I don't trust them, right? Mm-hmm. Think about that word, trust. And it took the autos a long time to recover from some of the events that they had around the safety of vehicles to build trust back within customers. It's why they have 5-star crash ratings and everything else, so that the consumer trusts that this vehicle is good. If you plan to do $30 billion, as just one OE announced, by the year 2030, on all the data that you're going to bring in from the vehicle to create all these new applications and services, how you handle that data is extremely important, not just what you do with it, right? And what you do with it is equally important and how you build trust. So when you go back to that point number six in cloud security posture management, you're bringing in all this data. Is, you know, paying down some of that technical debt, and are things secure, or do people have visibility to all this other data that you're bringing in, and then all these applications that you're building, also goes into the idea of where are you building it, right? Like, I think there's a lot to be said there. I know that was kind of long, but it all goes back to trust with your consumer, because overnight, you do one thing wrong today, or people find out you were using the data for reasons that they didn't really understand, mm-hmm. you can lose trust overnight. And that does take a while to rebuild.
Yeah, it's way easier to lose it than to get it back.
Right. And the reference back to Zoom, the fact that he handled it and addressed it as soon as he did, because I can remember back in Eric and Dan, when we were first getting on too, some of the conversations that were had around trust. And there was people that I did business with, and we get on a Zoom call, and a company said, hey, Brian, we're actually not allowed to use Zoom. We have to use this. Mm-hmm. And then in the conversation with them before we had the meeting, they're like, well, right now our business just doesn't trust using that platform.
That's right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, wow. But
they parlayed it and turned it into a massive success.
Mm-hmm.
So how companies handle that is really important. And again, just going back to being transparent. So as you pay down your vulnerability debt, these companies that are planning to use all this data, vehicle companies, are massive companies, right? So this shift, this paradigm shift to using the cloud and being able to work remote, and there's culture changes, there's tech changes, and the business model for them is also changing. It's a huge change. Mm-hmm. And the trust part, I think, is going to be really, really important. Trust with the employees internally, trust with your consumer, because you have a massive large consumer base, right? Think about all the people that use, and Dan, use Google or other tools to search on, right? It's why Brave became as popular as it did, right? You know, like, there's reasons why. And it's because when people have lack of transparency, they have lack of trust. So I think internally, how people pay down that debt, or why certain tools are brought in, are really going to need to be explained up to the business and the board. And that goes right into where you were talking about being also the trust officer, because it becomes imperative to the business. And if they can help kind of explain that narrative of why it's so important to the business and they embrace it, I think the consumer will see that as well. And it will reflect, like you just mentioned with Caterpillar, the ability for them to win business. But that was with one client. Now it's trying to win business when you're selling, you know, 1.1 million F-150s or 1.2 million F-150s. You want to keep that market share, right? You don't want to lose that business. So how you handle your customers' data, what you're doing with it, I could keep going on and on. I think that was way too many automotive references for one.
That was overwhelming, even for people in Detroit. Jess, since Brian brought up minimum viable security, just sort of, you know, the term itself conjures up, you know, the idea of the idea that does that mean I am skimping on security? Can you talk a little bit about some of the distinction there in the way that you wrote this and how that, hey, how those two things play into each other and what minimum viable security really translates into in the real world?
So yeah, this is one that we wanted to get out there as part of our research that we're doing on product security. We have an entire secure what you sell model. You know, I would encourage people to check it out. But yeah, I think this is going to take some communication on the part of the CISO and members of their team that minimal viable security doesn't necessarily equal bad security or insufficient security. It means that, you know, the key pieces of security are in place, right? So you're ensuring that products are launched with the right protections in place to begin with, but it's not so loaded up so as to cause inefficiencies or cause friction. You know, I would love to hear what your thoughts are on this from a product perspective as well, right? It has to make sure that it meets user expectations and make sure that it meets regulatory requirements, and you know, and that the company is comfortable going to market with that product with the security that's baked into it.
Yeah, and I think this is really important for security practitioners, because for so long it was back to this binary notion. It was binary. It's either insecure or it's secure. And if you want to make it secure, you must do everything that is in this list. And we've moved into a world of shades of gray, or I guess better said, risk management of what is this. Is this translates directly into the migration from a security mindset to a risk manage to a technology risk management mindset. And I mean, I think it as been building products, and especially when you're in the software world or things like that, it's making the decisions that make the most impact or that are the most critical, and then going to market. You can spend forever trying to get to perfect security and never actually ship. Mm-hmm. And now this is the stark contrast to the manufacturing world, or to the pharma world, where you can't take those things back. This is harder in hardware, where you can't bring those things back necessarily to fix a physical defect, but you can if it's in software. So you know, just doing some of those things and trying to figure it out, it's a hard discussion, especially again for people coming out of the more historical security realm, where it's do them all. Right. Rather than, okay, what are the risks of doing this? What's the potential impact? What, you know, what's the likelihood? And really thinking about it in risks. So, I mean, I'm a huge fan of this idea of what does it take to get something out the door and do it in a responsibly secure way. Mm-hmm. And with the understanding that you will also continue to grow on it where appropriate. It doesn't mean that just what's out the door is out the door and then you'll never look at it again.
Right. This to me is also about building goodwill, right? Security folks and developers have longstanding issues, right? And this is a way to help them understand that what we're doing right now is we're not asking for the moon, right? We're asking for things that we know will protect our customers when they're using and interacting with this product or service. And from there, we will build on it and iterate. So this isn't there aren't a bunch of flaws happening in this. We're not just letting something out the door that's Swiss cheese for hackers. There's the main prioritized, you know, risks have been mitigated with what we're asking these developers to put into this product.
It also means developers where they are. It means product teams exactly where they are on minimum viable product. Mm-hmm. What does it take to responsibly ship something that works? Mm-hmm. And what would it take to minimally ship something that works and is responsibly secure.
Right. And this is again where we're asking security leaders to use that goodwill, right? You've got this goodwill, use it to push minimum viable security and use it to pay down that you know vulnerability debt across not only products, but the enterprise.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I love this idea. And I think that again, there are some verticals that have made some of this shift to risk management 20 years ago, but I think banking was
medical devices.
Medical devices, yeah, exactly.
For sure.
You have one time to get, you have one shot. And granted, right. You can patch along the way for some of the componentry, but it is, yeah, and life is on the line. So you have some pretty dire consequences if you don't do it right. I really love this, especially as well as talking about the vulnerability response plan, the idea of how not just you make your assertion, but also that you're coming back around and keeping track of when something might still explode. The idea that it's not going out the door, nothing will ever be perfect, but we also have to have something that, an awareness to be able to fix it quickly. It's not just patching servers anymore. It's also building up a new security component in our products and services. As the world changes around us.
I was going to liken this to, on the cloud security posture management side, right? To, and then just bear with me, I'm going to go back to automotive again, but to
no. Eric.
Yeah, but if you took an assembly
give
line.
Over.
No, seriously, if you took an assembly line, right? With all these different, all these different processes, right? And each one you could consider a container. Right, that you're running some type of process in for your finished application coming off at the line. So Eric, you build in these quality controls, right? And production control, you have the PC team, the quality team, it really is going back to good hygiene, right? And you can continuously improve, right? So Dan, you mentioned you can't take back a physical product. Once you ship, if there's a defect in there, there's a defect in there. So you got to judge what the risk of that defect is. And if you're going to have a recall to fix it, or if it's something that, is okay, right? Is it viable, right? But then going back to the cloud security posture management and paying down some of your vulnerability debt, Eric, that goes right back to when you look at your production line. Each year that goes by and you do improvements, you realize that maybe some of the investments that were made for different controls were not needed, right? But this is needed. And having visibility into that is very important. If you just scrapped all the visibility and it was only in runtime that you were looking at things, the number of things that you wouldn't know, right? And the amount of bad that could go out, right? Could be massive.
Right.
And I think the principle of that, Jess, when I was reading it, I absolutely love, because I hearken it back to the idea of some of the production control systems and quality systems that are put in that manufacturing maybe has mastered over years of producing an actual finished good, but now they need to go back and think about as their business adapts and changes to actually producing, services and using other data, right? And I think it's very likable to that. Eric, thoughts on that?
On the vulnerability, I mean, one of the things that I liked as well, that it kind of hit on the understanding asset inventory, kind of the same thing on what's in the line, right? You don't know what your vulnerabilities are. You don't know what you're protecting if you don't know what it is you're trying to protect, right? Until you've got that inventory, you have nothing. It doesn't matter the transparency that you're trying to create. So I think that's good in kind of calling out that if you look at security, and this kind of plays into the MVP, that if we try to take on everything all at once, we likely won't accomplish anything, right? Security is an art of building blocks and understanding how those build upon each other. And there are there's orders to do certain things, right? That until you have, and this gets to I love the CIS 18 because of this, that it's kind of a linear fashion. Until you have hardware, software, inventories, you can't do vulnerability management because you don't have that data. You don't know what you're trying to pull it from, but it's certainly kind of a key aspect.
Well, we somehow whittled through 56 minutes worth of discussion.
Wow.
And it felt like it was about 45 seconds. clearly some really great topics. Jess, is there anything you want everybody listening or watching to consider as a result of this, report, something for people to take away and keep in mind as they go away?
Well, I mean, I think security leaders should think about, the rest of this year. Gosh, we're already almost in May, which is incredible, but thinking about what do you want to do with this one wild and precious moment of goodwill that you have, right? Since you've made it through these last 2 years, and what does that mean to your program? And I think you should think about, as a security leader, what does trust mean to you in your role, and what can it make, what can you do with it to actually create better alignment with the business and let them know what you're really there for, which is to grow revenue and to win, serve, and retain customers. So, think about trust and think about what a trusted business means, no matter what your industry is, and no matter what your level of regulation is, and sort of take your program from there, because it is so much more than you know, the operations piece, right? It's so much more than the SOC. That's so critical, but your role is expanded now, and it's time to get out there and use that spotlight.
It's what we've been asking for 25 years. Now we've got it. We better go do something with it.
Do something with it. Yeah.
Neat. For those listening, there's a link to the blog post that talks about this, this piece of research on the show notes and in the description. Go there. There's a link for your Forrester client. There's a link to the actual research report itself. So go check it out. Jess, any other research coming up that you're really interested in or that really keeps you going?
Yeah, well, the certifications research has been fascinating. I'm working with our researcher and just, you know, again, analyze hundreds and hundreds of social media posts. Probably some of yours are in there about how you feel about security certifications and what that means. And really, it's written for security leaders when it comes to thinking about hiring, right? Hiring and developing folks and thinking about, again, blowing up some of the traditional notions about bringing in folks at the entry level. So I'm excited about that.
The closing of that be the one answer to the question, how do I get started in information security, that we get asked over and over. Boy, I'd love to see that be a research.
Yeah, I think there's going to be some focus on that. So stay tuned for that. And yeah, just there's so much more to come. I'm going to be covering more email security, looking at, you know, products that we call CAPES, which are the API enabled email security solutions out there. Going to be looking at attack surface management in more detail, looking at that is a very volatile market right now in terms of acquisitions and just who's using attack surface management in what different use case. So more to come on that. Like so much on my docket, I don't even know what to say. I just need to get in a room and start writing.
Can't wait. Jess Byrne, I will put the link to your profile and blog on Forrester into the show notes as well. So
thank
people
you.
Can read all. Where are you on Twitter, and where can people find you?
Yeah, so it's at Jess_Byrne_ on Twitter, where you can find me. And then on LinkedIn, you know, it's a pretty straightforward link to my profile.
Excellent. Jess, thank you so much for being here. I can't wait for 12 months to pass and do this again.
We could try to squeeze another one in beforehand.
Oh, you know? Yes, of course. And thanks again, of course, to Eric and Brian for another great security debate. And thanks to you, the listener. We really love having you, and we really love your feedback. Please share with us the things you think about this episode, any episodes, future topics that you'd like to see us cover. You can email us at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. You can find us on Twitter @securitydebate. And you can go to our website to find all of the past episodes and links to where to subscribe in your favorite podcast app, links to the YouTube, and everything you need to know. That is at www.greatsecuritydebate.net. Until the next time, we'll see you on the next Great Security Debate.